Welcome to the London Buddhist Centre's podcast, bringing you the Dharma and guided meditations. If you found value in listening, please consider making a donation. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Thank you for that. As always, when I come here, there's always a very generous introduction. I always think that's the best bit. We can all go home now. And it's a delight to be here. I've been here for just over a week in London doing different things. I live in Norfolk at a retreat centre called Padmaloka. So I live in the countryside in the beautiful South Norfolk countryside. And I like coming to London, though, because I like to see and experience practicing Buddhism, practicing meditation, practicing the Dharma in an urban environment, and be with people who are practicing in a big city. It's really interesting meditating upstairs every morning to the sound of sirens and traffic, very different from the bird song and the occasional tractor that I experience in Norfolk. And it's stimulating. It's stimulating for spiritual practice. As Akasha Mitra said, I've got a lot of friends here. And I was wondering about what to talk about this evening. And I came up with a title called The Wondrous House of the Dharma. The Dharma being the Buddha's teaching, the Wondrous House of the Dharma. And what I want to talk about is this. This is the Wondrous House of the Dharma, the Wondrous House of the Buddha's teaching. And I want to talk about why. Why? Why not? Because we can do it online now. Hello, online people. Lockdown taught us how to transmit electronically throughout the world, and that's a wonderful thing. We did a lot of that from Padmaloka, that's a great thing. I know, talking to friends in Berlin, a lot of people who come along, and maybe it's the same with you, have come along because of meditation apps, YouTube videos, different meditation teachers. Why go somewhere? Why go somewhere? Why go somewhere to learn about Buddhism and meditation and practice? Can't we just do it in our own home? And of course, that's perfectly legitimate to do that. And it's the full moon, as Kusala Sara said. The full moon days are, in traditional Buddhist countries, are days of great celebration. Traditionally, it's as the time said, when spiritual practice is much more effective in societies which run on a lunar calendar. The moon, the phases of the moon are so important and woven into people's lives, woven into their practice. And yes, there's the idea that the waxing moon and the waxed moon somehow increases the efforts that we make. So people will go to the Buddhist temple, they'll go to the monastery, they'll gather together. And this is a venerable tradition. It goes right back to the Buddha himself and his own disciples meeting on new moon days, full moon days, to meditate together, to stay up all night meditating, sitting in the Aryan silence, as they call it, the noble silence, the transcendental silence, or hearing talks on the Dharma, on Buddhism, or communicating together. And while Kusala Sara was talking, I was listening to Kusala Sara, but I looked out at the full moon and I noticed something in the moon. And I hadn't thought about this, but there he is. There's a hair in the moon. If you look closely, you can see the shape of a hair. You can see its ears at the top and you can see its head, joined to the ears. And there he is, the moon, the hare in the moon. And this goes back to a traditional Buddhist story, what's known as a Jataka, a birth story. And it's a story when the Buddha, in a previous life, this is a very popular story, was a hare. And some friends were coming for dinner. I forget the different animals that were coming for dinner, but They were coming for dinner, so he wanted to put on a really good spread, being a really good friend, being a really good host. It's India, after all, and, you know, being a good host in India is such an important, just part of life. It's part of the courtesies of life. And but I think it was Indra or Mara or somebody decided to test the hare. So they just kept stealing all the food that he would gather, making it disappear until there was no food. And they were coming. And the pot was on the stove. And the hare thought, I've got to give them something. I'll give them me. So he jumped into the pot to serve up a good meal. At which point, Indra, the king of the gods, took him out of the pot, gave even more lavish food, and inscribed him in the full moon, just to illustrate this supreme act of giving, of sacrifice, of welcome to friends. So there was I, looking at the hare in the moon, thinking about welcome, thinking about courtesy, thinking about hospitality. And I hope very much that the first thing you experienced when you came into the centre was welcome, was hospitality. It's such an important quality, human quality. It's not particularly Buddhist. It should be especially Buddhist, but it's a human quality, isn't it? That act of welcoming people into your house, into your home, into your heart, actually. You know, when people meet for the first time, it's that I love meeting people for the first time, or people I haven't seen for a long time, because it's always a welcoming, a mutual welcoming. And there's something in the quality of welcome that is very, very open, isn't it? If you genuinely welcome somebody, you're very open to what is going to arise, both parties. Very open to the possibilities. It's sometimes even the act of welcome, as well as being delightful. There's also a slight, oh, what's going to happen? A slight thrill in a way, because you're opening your heart. They're opening your heart. And perhaps when you first came to the centre, you had that mixture of things going on. Hopefully you were welcomed. I'm sure you were here. People very pleased to see you and welcome you in into the space and showing you where things are. That's so, so important in Buddhist centres that we do that. If that didn't happen, by all means, go and talk to an order member and say, well, I wasn't welcomed. And they'll do something about it. Very, very important quality. Such an important quality. Such an important quality to learn, I think, to communicate. And yes, it opens you to the next things that happen when you come into this place. And that's the first, in a way, first thing, I think, that's so important about having a place to go to in order to learn and practice Buddhism. You immediately have a direct human contact. Of course, you can have that online as well. People can be very welcoming through that medium. But there's something about the physicality of going to a place, of going to a community and being greeted and being welcomed in. It starts something. In a way, it's your first entry even onto the Buddhist path, even though you might not have decided to follow the Buddhist path just yet. Actually, that friendly welcome is so, so important. I mean, I listen to a lot of life stories where I live, because it's where we train people for ordination into our order, and in various ways people talk about their life story, and frequently, almost, you know, regularly, they talk about their first meeting with somebody at a Buddhist centre. Doesn't always go well, has to be said, but they get over that. They take it as a teaching, as you do. But by and large, what they really are impressed by is that sense of welcome. I might come back to that a bit more. But then after that, you come into the shrine room, you take your seats, and then what happens when you're first along? What's the next thing that happens? There's instruction. Very, very important instruction. Perhaps a rather, you know, perhaps not an entirely popular word these days, but you are instructed. You're taught the Dharma, usually in the form of meditation, when you first come along. And hopefully it's very clear instruction. You get very, very clear and precise instruction about how to meditate, how to sit in meditation, what your posture is, how to turn your mind to the breath, for example, how to generate loving kindness. Immediately with that, you're being instructed in Buddhism, whether you know it or not. And I know when people first come, we're usually quite, you know, almost not exactly secular. It can't be when you've got a great big Buddha image in the shrine. But we sort of play that down. But immediately you've actually stepped onto the Buddhist path, because you're being taught what's known as bhavana. The word for meditation, these practices, mindfulness of breathing, development of loving kindness, they're bhavanas. Bhavana literally means making to become. Making to become. This is absolutely fundamental Buddhist teaching, even Buddhist teaching about reality, that we can make ourselves to become something different. We can enter a process of transformation, that we don't have to remain the same person with the same habitual responses. We're not sort of doomed to a particular fate because of our conditioning of one kind or another. As you go on, you'll hear more of that kind of teaching, that the essence of the Dharma is that everything is change. Everything changes in dependence upon conditions. And you can actually modify the conditions. You can get a hold of the conditions in your life, in your mind especially, but also externally, and change them. Slowly, slowly, gradually, gradually, you can actually start changing things so that you can live a much more, well, to use the kind of buzzword that we would use, is a much more creative life. A life where, you know, you are living it how you want to live it, rather than feeling sort of pushed around, shunted around by different sort of forces, or feeling that you're on sort of tram tracks, tube tracks, you know, just going down that tunnel. You know, you can actually break out into something quite different. There is the possibility, even if you want to, if you want to keep going, of gaining enlightenment, of following the path to the Buddha's nirvana, even his parinirvana, which you're going to hear about next week on the festival day. So instruction is very, very important. The word for instruction in Buddhism is desana. Desana, instruction, is not a literal translation. Desana means something like a showing, a revealing, a pointing out, a showing to you of something that you can do and that you can apply. And of course, what goes with that is practice. Because immediately, when you first come along, you're not only shown how to meditate, you meditate. I think that's very, very significant. That as very, very early on in your involvement, you actually start to do something. You actually do the sort of fundamental Buddhist practices immediately. There's not just instruction. There's another thing that goes on as and this progresses as time goes on. There's discussion. It's not one way. Yes, you will have, you know, the LBC, the London Buddhist Centre. You've got great teachers. I know them. Great, not just great meditation teachers, but great teachers of the Dharma. I was here last week listening to Jnanavacha just unfold, you know, the Dharma, Buddhist ideas, in an incredibly rich way. And I was very impressed as well by the way he taught, because he invited responses in the midst of his of his showing of the Dharma. I'm not doing that, I'm just going to speak. So there was a response, and there'll be more of that. There'll be, you often have discussion groups, study groups. You engage in a practice, well, you're not just listening, you're engaging in a practice called Dhamma Katha, which means literally talking the Dhamma, or even talking the truth. Yes, you learn what the Buddha's vision of life is. You learn how that's applied through different practices, ethical practices, meditation practices, wisdom practices. But you also have to work out how that relates to your experience, to your life. And that happens through honest, heart-to-heart discussion and exploration. And it might even be quite fiery sometimes. You know, sometimes, you know, you have cherished ideas, views of things, and they start bumping up against, you know, what you find in the Dhamma. There might appear to be conflict. Maybe there is conflict. Maybe there isn't. But you have to kind of go through that process of a real, if you like, deep searching, a totally honest exploration of the truth together. So you have that here, live, in the centre. It's harder to do that online. It's much better to do that when you're face to face, when you've got that live exchange. And of course, it's not simply to do with the words that you're using, it's the whole physical human presence, you know, that whole interaction that goes on. It's gesture, it's everything, you know, and maybe smell as well that we pick up on, I don't know. But so important to engage in that. So much wisdom, I think, is distilled through that honest discussion as you learn to apply the Dhamma to, you know, to your life. So that's instruction, discussion, practice, that whole area, that all develops. And of course, sometimes, you know, when you come to the Buddhist center, maybe early on, maybe later on, you start hearing things that really strike you, that kind of break through the thousands and millions of words, rubbish words, that we're exposed to. I was thinking of giving a talk tonight on the thousands, a chapter from a famous Buddhist text, which begins, "Better than a thousand meaningless words is one word that brings peace." That's one translation. The word is upasanta, which can also mean satisfaction, meaning, ease, appeasement. Better than a thousand meaningless words is one word that brings that deep satisfaction, that sense of meaning, or one verse that does that. And sometimes you get that. You hear something and it's strange, new, and deeply familiar, as if you've always known it. There's a thing that people often say when they talk about coming to a Buddhist center. It becomes almost a cliche, but it's cliches often reveal the truth. I felt as though I'd come home. It's not just the place, it's also the word or the words. And we need those words. We need those words. I was reading this line of the Buddha. I was reminding of a fragment from a Paul Celan poem, which in translation goes something like, "Waiting for a word from a thinker, a hope for the heart." And we do long for that, don't we, I think? We're waiting for a word of, you know, or a verse of the deepest meaning that goes right to the heart and opens up vision. Because we need vision. Human beings need vision, as it says in the Old Testament. Without vision, the people perish. There is wisdom in the Old Testament. Without vision, the people perish. We perish without a vision of life, without some kind of meaning of life. When you have real vision and real meaning, what then opens up, I think, and again, it's something you can get from the center, from the wondrous house of the Dharma, is inspiration and enthusiasm. There's another thing I feel we badly need in human life. Inspiration, enthusiasm. Both words, when you go back to their old etymologies, Greek, Latin, mean something like a divine, an entry of the divine. You know, a god has entered, a goddess has entered. And you are roused and infused and inspired. And it seems to me that you know, there's a lot of problems, aren't there, in the world. We know them only too well because we're reminded of them all the time through, you know, social media and you know, news feeds and everything else. And it's very easy to lose hope, and very easy to lose enthusiasm and inspiration, and very easy, I think, to become depressed. And I personally believe that a lot of depression is because we won't allow enthusiasm and inspiration to fill us. I don't believe depression is all to do with, you know, terrible traumas in the past or things like that. I think a lot of the problems we have are because we suppress or repress our positive responses. I don't think everything that's repressed or suppressed is bad stuff. I think a lot of people are just, in a way, dying. I think that's the word, perishing from not being able to express their love, their enthusiasm, their inspiration, their positive qualities. And one of the things I hope very much for a Buddhist centre is that, well, I know the people here, they're full of enthusiasm. I mean, they have their ups and downs, they have their bad days and off days, like we all do, but they're absolutely inspired by the Dharma. And it's real. It's not just happy, clappy, I'm saved. That's not the vibe that comes from them at all, because they're very honest, authentic people. But they have a tremendous enthusiasm, inspiration, and that transmits. That transmits, and you can open to that, I think. It's sort of in the air. The sort of fundamental need for enthusiasm and inspiration was brought home to me when I lived in India for many years, and I was immersed in the Buddhist community that were people who'd converted from Hinduism, because they were regarded as Dalits, as untouchables, and Buddhism was a path of liberation for them. And their great leader, Dr. Ambedkar, in the great conversion speech, talked about the need for enthusiasm, the need for energy, and becoming a Buddhist was all about enthusiasm, because he said, when you come to Buddhism, you breathe in an atmosphere. This was his phrase, really interesting phrase. You breathe in an atmosphere, you breathe an air, if you like, a whole environment in which it's clear that the fruits will come from your own efforts to develop yourself. And no human being, no individual is exempted from that with the Buddha's vision. So enthusiasm comes in the end from the fruits, if you like, of living this life where your actions are having an effect on you, on others, on your environment. So I hope very much when you come here, there's that magic of enthusiasm and inspiration. Of course, it's not something that you can guarantee. You know, in a god or a goddess, you know, won't just come because, you call them. In fact, they tend to come when you least expect it. They won't come at your beck and call. But yes, enthusiasm, inspiration, energy will come from the fruits of your practice. So this leads me to the next thing. I'm talking, you know, very much about the effect of the people who are running this centre. Excuse me, I'm a bit dry. The next thing I think that can start to happen, or another thing that can start to happen when you come into the wondrous house of the Dharma, is friendship and friendliness. This is a very, very important value for us, a very, very important part of human life. We put a lot of emphasis on that meditation, the development of loving kindness, which apparently a lot of people have problems with. Do you still do the course, Who Hates the Metta Bhavana? Who Hates the Metta Bhavana? Catchy title. yes, for some reason people find it very hard, especially the first stage, you know, loving themselves or tuning into a sort of sense of goodwill for themselves. I mean, you've probably heard me say this, but I've never had trouble with the first stage. I don't know if I'm deluding myself, but I've always found the first stage very enjoyable. Not, I think, because I'm an out-and-out narcissist. I think because the way I've learned to do it, if you like, is to, first and foremost, meditate on what I have. So rather than thinking, I haven't, you know, I'm not a good person, I haven't got this and I haven't got that, I think of what I have, starting with the basics. I'm alive. And actually that's a good thing, even when I'm in a bad mood. I am actually alive, and there's a basic sense of being alive. And I mean simply sensing, you know, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, being able to think. I mean, thinking is an incredible thing, actually, if you think about it. Being able to reflect upon my experience is a magical thing. I mean, very often our reflection, our experience goes horribly wrong. You know, especially if we start comparing ourselves unfavourably with others or some weird abstract ideal, which we're not even clear what it is, but just makes us feel bad. You know, which we're sort of unconsciously holding, that we've sort of learned somehow. No, we can do a lot better than that. You know, it's actually, you know, being a human being is actually a really wonderful thing. In Buddhist tradition, it's called to meditate, to reflect on the precious human existence is a fundamental meditation. Oh, and the tradition says, well, if you've been reborn as a human being, you must have done a lot of good in a previous life. I'm not saying you will have to believe in previous lives or anything like that, but the tradition is very, very clear. That's great. Look what you've got. You've got this human kit. You can sense, you can feel, you can reflect. You know, you can actually reflect, oh, that's not helpful, that's helpful. Let's develop this. Let's not do that. This is magic. You know, it's nothing particularly religious about it. This is a human faculty. You can even imagine in a very, very positive way. You can even imagine, even have a vision for yourself of becoming something like the Buddha. You can move in that direction realistically. You can have a sort of principle in your life that can inspire you and move you, so that you can live not under its oppression, but under its inspiration and influence that starts to inform, you know, all of your activities. So that's the kind of thing that goes on for me, you know, when I do the first stage of the metta. I think about the friends who've, you know, given me so much. I think about my teacher. You know, I think about all the good conditions that are around that support me. So many things you can go through. This is the practice, of course, of gratitude, which is a kind of wisdom in Buddhism. It's called katanyata in Pali, which means, or kritajnana in Sanskrit, which means literally knowledge of the benefits that you've received. Knowledge, knowing. You know, you see what you've been given. Yeah, sure, maybe you've had a hard life. Maybe bad things have happened. Understand that. But even more importantly than to look to the good, what have you been given that's beneficial? You're also starting to learn more about conditionality, about what we call conditioned co-production, how actions against have consequences. But very, very positively, you're meditating on what the Tibetans call the auspicious coincidence of events, things coming together and positively influencing you and affecting you. And of course, when you recognize that, you start to feel good. You know, you start to fill up, you start to feel a lot of well-being. And of course, then that turns into metta for others, thinking of your friends and so on, expanding, expanding, expanding. So friendliness, love, friendship is really important in the center. Have to be a bit careful with the word friendship, because the word friendship sort of implies you might set up an expectation that, you know, all of the people here who run the centre are going to give you everything that you've never had, as good friends should surely do. And, well, that won't happen. It won't be like that. They'll be friendly. But friendship is something that grows. It grows through time. It goes through coming together, practicing together, being together, going on retreat together, that kind of thing. And friendship is also, I mean, it's one of those things in human life that can be so easily neglected. And we use the word so loosely, I think. You know, acquaintances can be friends. I mean, real friendship, as one writer said, a Christian writer, should, if it's true friendship, it should have a touch of eternity to it. It should transcend, if you like, the ravages of time and all the sort of difficulties that can sometimes plague human relationship. There should be something that's developing in all of the parties involved, which is, well, an unconditional befriending. That's what we're looking to do. So when you come to the centre and you enter this world of friendship, think of being a friend rather than having a friend. I mean, the surest way to gain friends is to be a friend yourself and to just commit yourself to being friendly. It's very difficult, I think, if some people can be very lonely and, you know, they desperately want friends and complain that nobody are friends, but they're miserable or angry. And you think, you're never going to get friends like that, you know. It'd be nice if you did meet people who were unconditionally loving to you, no matter how you were to them. But get real. I mean, it isn't going to happen. You've actually got to do something. You've actually got to become a friendly, generous person, interested in other people. You know, forgetting about yourself for a while and entering their world. And friendship transcends all of the different sort of things that, you know, the way we see the world. It transcends class, race, caste, nationality. It can transcend language. I mean, I have very, very good friends in India, some of my closest friends, and their English is not so good, and my Marathi is pretty poor. But I feel very, very close to them. We reached places where we didn't need words. You know, we're practicing the Dharma together, working for the Dharma together, and, you know, we could just look at each other or just be shoulder to shoulder and know that we were friends. And friendship really does assuage this terrible loneliness that can afflict people. This Christian writer, Aelred of Rivo, an English Cistercian monk, 14th century, who wrote beautifully about spiritual friendship. In one of his discourses, he says, a friend is another self. A friend is another self. I think that's one of the profoundest things you could actually say about friendship. A friend is another self. Have you ever had that feeling? I hope you've had that feeling, where a really close friend, they're kind of you and not you. You know what I mean? They're you insofar as you can say anything to them. You can tell them all your secrets. And when I say secrets, I don't mean necessarily all the negative things, all those things. I mean your inspirations, your enthusiasms. The things that you dream about, you can share them without being ridiculed or without indifference or with compassion if it's a very painful experience. They are you in that sense, they are another self, but they are another. So they're kind of you and not you. So you can say to them as if you're talking to another, and they can reflect you back, they can help you in your hour of need. And you can have that here in time. It starts to happen. It does. I just know that it happens. I mean, it's happened to me so many times, you know, in my Buddhist practice, in my Buddhist training. Of course, friendships have their ups and downs. We know that. Don't think that, you know, coming to the wondrous house of the Dharma, that it's all going to be perfect and you're all going to be saved tonight and transported to some place. Not like that. A lot of these things are hard won. You know, this place is a place of practice. It is a kind of crucible, if you like, where you know, you do come up against yourself and come up against other people. But friendship is just so important. And of course, it starts expanding outward. I mean, I've been coming here so long, I've seen people sometimes when they were kind of beginners. And then the next time I've come, they're on the team running the class. They've come along, they've been befriended, then they start befriending. They start welcoming. An amazing thing to see, very inspirational to see that whole movement, that whole process is a horrible word, but that whole movement of someone's life and their involvement in a community and how that develops. So there's one last thing I want to talk about the wondrous house of the Dharma. So I've talked about, very hot. I've talked about friendly welcome, courtesy, hospitality. I've talked about instruction and discussion and practice. I've talked about enthusiasm and inspiration. And I've talked about friendship and friendliness. There's one final thing I want to talk about, which I can't find the words for. Don't worry, it's nothing transcendental. It's nothing mystical. It's this. It's a place. It's the actual place. It's the bodying forth of the Dharma in the building. The whole building. I've been thinking a lot about place recently. I've been reading a particular writer about the importance of place. He's actually, this writer's writing about ecology and contemplation, environment and contemplation. He's talking about the importance of place and habitat. Yes, we know that for the state of the world, of course, but for human beings, you know, for the health of human beings, the importance of place, of being rooted in place. You know, and of course, being in London, one's very conscious of if you like, migrations, of people moving through. That's what happens in big cities, you know, understandably, people earning a living or studying or something like that. But even so, I think it's very important to find place and to even try to be rooted in place, if you like, wherever you are. Try to sense that place, feel that place. A lot of the time these days, I think people are inhabiting non-places. You know, I was catching the train back. Where was I coming from? I was coming back from Berlin, that's right. So I was catching the train from Stansted up to Norwich. And I was sitting with these young guys, young men and women who come out of college, obviously. And they were talking, but they were also doing this on their phones. It's quite astonishing, the speed of... I mean, okay, call me old. I know I'm old. But, you know, there they were. Psh, 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 like, dislike, you know, book, book. I was staying with my nephew's family over in Ealing for the weekend and with my 16-year-old daughter and 14-year-old son. Unbelievable powers of response. I mean, you know, phone, laptop, telly... You know, crikey. I mean, anyway, I'm sure they're fine. but I do, sorry, I'm really sounding like an old man, aren't I? But really out of touch. But there's also something I want to say that I think is important, that spending time online, I don't do much of it. I can't keep up. But I think they're not really places. They're abstract, they're illusions of place, I think. And with all respect to people online, tonight. But we're coming from a place, you're actually with us, you know, it's different. You know, and you know, I get it. I get the importance of that kind of transmission. During lockdown, we did a lot from Padmaloka, the Padmaloka Shrine Room, which is an incredible place. I mean, it's just full of images. It's really a Buddhist temple. And people were so grateful to feel that they were with us, joining in with us from their places. But there's something about place and being rooted that I think is so, so important. It's very interesting for me coming back here, you know, and Akasha Mitra talking about me working on this old fire station. I mean, it's a fire station. It was a fire station. I mean, look at the symbolism of that. You know, firefighters lived here back in Victorian times or whatever it was. They put out fires, and didn't the Buddha say that all is burning? All is on, the eye is burning, the ear is burning, everything is on fire with craving, hatred and delusion. What an amazing place to have a Buddhist centre. It was meant to happen. You know, I mean, the council did want to get it off their hands, and they were sort of desperate for some some you know, over-idealistic young men to come in and do something to it. But it's a fire station. It's on a Roman road. The thing I'm trying to get at is that this place has a history. This whole environment has a history. There are roots here. It's covered over with, you know, so much urban development. But there is a story here. There's a history here. And of course, there's a lot of Buddhist history here. There's a lot of atmosphere in this place. I'm sitting in a place where there have been so many talks on Buddhism given. My Buddhist teacher gave talks from here, really inspirational talks from here. There's this incredible rupa. I was around when that was being made. There's a whole story here. There are multiple stories in the walls and in the place. So it's good, I think, important to come to a place that has all that history, all that, all those deep roots going right back, but also into these times, this place being transformed into, yeah, the wondrous house of the Dharma. And of course, you're part of that. You know, you keep coming, you keep being involved. It becomes your place. It becomes your place where you become rooted in your Dharma practice. There will be other places like Vajrasana, the fantastic retreat centre that the LBC runs, and other retreat centres. And no doubt there are places of your own that you go to in the countryside, or your home, or your family home, or something like, wherever it might be. So important, I think, to go to those places to contemplate, to feel that sense that you aren't isolated, that you're close to place. Because we're not isolated creatures. I mean, I think that's the problem with online stuff. You enter this very weird inner mental world, I think, whereas place, you know, we're creatures operating in self and other, in self and world, and we need to make our Buddhist practice very, very much an expression of that. So, here we are, in this place, in this wondrous house of the Dharma on a full moon night. And I think I'd better stop at this point so that we can, if you want to stay, do the full moon puja. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you know why we have this now, the London Buddhist Centre, why you come here. And I hope very much you don't not only enjoy being here, but that you're properly instructed. You know, there's good practice, good discussion, there's inspiration and enthusiasm, there's friendship in this place. Thank you.